Hi, my name is Jim Rossi. I'm a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School, and today I'm delighted to have with us Mike Vandenberg, who is the David Daniels Allen Distinguished Chair of Law and the director of the Climate Change Research Network and co-director of the Energy, Environment, and Land Use Program at Vanderbilt Law School. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Vandenberg.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to get a chance to talk with you, Jim.
And Professor Vandenberg, for many years, has been a leading scholar who writes in environmental and energy law. And he's the author of a recent book with Professor Jonathan Gilligan. This book is called Beyond Politics, The Private Governance Response to Climate Change. I find it a very refreshing book, and I want to begin our conversation today by just asking Professor Vandenberg if you can define for us what you mean by private governance.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And it was a pleasure to work with a physicist on many of these projects, Jonathan Gilligan. And I think that what we're seeing more and more is a real growth in the number of people. Sarah Light at Wharton has done quite a work in this area, Eric Ortz at Wharton, and quite a few others around the country are beginning to look at this. And what is the this then? I define private environmental governance as occurring when organizations perform the traditionally governmental roles of reducing negative externalities, affecting the distribution of environmental amenities, et cetera. So essentially, I don't look at intent, I look at the function of their activity. And I say when they're performing a traditionally governmental function, that's when what we have is environmental governance. Is private environmental governance.
So this is an interesting contrast with how we often think of private versus public. You often think private and you think about the purely business side or the side that's aiming to seek to maximize profits or to do something that the government's not doing. But you're viewing it as something that's compatible with government and a supplement and complement to government.
That's right. And let me start perhaps by just identifying some of the different ways in which private governance is different from many of the similar concepts that people conflate it with over time. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about what would drive private organizations to perform governmental functions, because I think our understanding of that is far too thin right now. So first, you know, what is private governance not? First, let me give you an example of what it is, and then we can talk about what it's not, because I think that's critically important to understand the opportunities here and the risks, too. So an example of private environmental governance is that roughly 800 of the largest companies in the world have committed to science-based targets. It's called the Science-Based Targets Initiative. So they have committed to a carbon pathway for their organization that is consistent with achieving a 2C or even a 1.5C goal. Similarly, more than $100 trillion is held by institutional investors who have committed to CDP, which used to be called the Carbon Disclosure Project, which is putting pressure on companies to disclose and reduce their carbon emissions around the world. A third quick example is Walmart, which feels pressure to improve its reputation and responds by working with the Environmental Defense Fund and other World Wildlife Fund, other organizations to commit to 1 billion tons of carbon emissions reductions from its supply chain by 2030. And it has over 60,000 suppliers. It would be roughly the sixth largest trading partner with China if it were a country. So when Walmart does that, if it is genuine, and we can see whether or not it's genuine in part by the fact that we've got NGOs who don't have an interest in helping them greenwash looking over their shoulder, if it does that, it then creates a private system of supply chain contracts and supply chain requirements that cause a reduction in carbon emissions that is equal to Germany or Japan going carbon neutral for an entire year. So that's sort of the core in the climate area of what I mean by private governance. You see it also with the Marine Stewardship Council in the fisheries area, which governs more than 10% of all the fish caught for human consumption. You see it in forests, in fair trade, in organic and other areas. So
thinking about the energy sector, for example, during this presidential campaign, much of the talk surrounding climate change has centered around the Green New Deal. And the Green New Deal puts government action at the center of the response to climate change as a way of really shifting the energy sector forward to carbon reduction and ultimately zero carbon emissions. By contrast, you're suggesting private interests, business initiatives can be at the center of the response.
Right. And just
why put the focus on the private side rather than the public side?
Good. So let me say a word or two more about how these differ, because I think that will help explain why I'm focused on the private sector. And let me be clear. Nothing that I'm doing is designed to displace what the government needs to do. I believe that we need major, urgent carbon emissions reductions. And I personally would support anything from a Green New Deal to a carbon tax of any sort, frankly, because I think we need to act urgently. So none of this is designed to displace any one of those potential options. But first, let me just say a word about what it is not. So private governance is not privatization. So it's not taking federal action and contracting it out. It's also not a situation in which you simply have government cooperating with the private sector. Instead, it is situations in which the private sector is motivated for a series of reasons to fill gaps in what government would do or complement what government is already doing. So why do I think this is so important, and why am I focused on that rather than simply saying, well, how do we find a way to get to a Green New Deal or something else? And I think for that, what we need to do is understand two things. One, to be realistic about the limits of what government is likely to do in the near term. And number two, to understand more fully what is actually driving private organizations. And by the way, I include not only corporations, but also religious organizations, colleges and universities, civic and cultural organizations. I put them all into the private sector. But let's start with government. And why do I think that we need private governance in addition to public governance? And the answer is that people have, I think, a very thin and often very naive sense of what is possible from a public governance perspective. If you look at the constitutional design, the Electoral College is heavily weighted towards small states. The Senate, more than 50 votes in the Senate are controlled by 18% of the U.S. population who live in small states, small population states. And then the power of the Senate over nominees enables that control of the White House and that control of the Senate to lead to control of the judiciary. So essentially 2.5 branches of the U.S. government are controlled by a fairly small percentage of the U.S. population. And that's not something you can change without constitutional changes, which in and of itself requires more effort. And what we've seen over time is that there has been real movement among moderates and liberals toward being concerned about climate change. But what we haven't seen is movement at almost any to almost any extent among conservatives and libertarians. And that population is a large part of that 18% of the population that controls the U.S. Senate and has an undue influence on the Electoral College. So from my perspective, we need urgent major action, but because we need urgent major action, it is not a smart move to then assume that all of a sudden we will get some kind of major transformation in government's willingness to adopt and quickly implement major carbon emissions reductions. And so that's what I'm worried about. So let me turn, if I may, for a really quick second to, if that's true, well, what about the private sector? Why should we think the private sector will act? And I think we have to be realistic that many of the players in the private sector are doing everything they can to reduce the likelihood that government will act. And that's certainly not something that I'm in favor of. I think we need to deal with this climate problem. But by the same token, I think we have to recognize that we do have the government we have. We do have the distribution of the population we have. Roughly a little less than a third of the population identifies as liberal. A little less than a third identifies as conservative. And about 40% identifies as moderate or independent. And so that's the population that we're given. They're not going to all of a sudden change their minds. So here's why the private sector, I think, has more potential to move than many people think. And I've done research in this area, and we've reviewed research in our book, et cetera, and you're welcome to dive into greater detail. I'd love more questions on this. But we believe that there are a set of drivers that people misestimate in terms of their power in shifting corporate behavior. And what are those? So companies can find major efficiencies. They can save money by reducing fossil fuel use in many cases or other resource use. So they have a financial incentive to reduce their carbon footprint because they are reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. And we'll find that Walmart and many other firms have found they save major amounts of money when given the opportunity and the urgency to go find carbon emissions reductions. A second factor is that in many cases, investors are pushing companies to reduce their emissions. And those investors are probably working based on a combination of incentives. They're worried about climate risks. They're worried about consumer pressure that would arise from concern about climate. They're worried about future regulatory risks. But for whatever basket of reasons, they are then turning around and putting real pressure on companies to reduce their carbon emissions. The same is true for lenders. More than 90% of all the project finance funding in the world is by banks that are part of the Equator Principles, which require companies when they do a project, wherever they are in the world, regardless of what the public law is, to have a plan for identifying and reducing their carbon emissions from a new project. Similarly, insurers, about two dozen insurers around the world, are maybe because they're worried about their reputation, maybe because they're worried about the impact on the investments that they make, maybe they're worried in part about the kind of payouts they'll have to do. For whatever reason, they are then putting pressure on companies to reduce their carbon emissions by saying things like, we won't invest in coal mines in the future, or we rather won't insure coal mines in the future. Then reputation generally is a huge factor. Much of the value of many companies is reputation. And what's interesting is that if you're in government, through the constitutional design, through campaign finance, through gerrymandering, you can essentially gerrymander the effect of the American population on government. But it's really hard to do that if you're trying to sell widgets to all Americans across the country. It's very hard to lose an entire part of your customer base. So companies worry that they won't be able to have insurance customers or financial investment customers or walk into a retail store or whatever it might be if they have a bad reputation. And so I think reputation is behind a lot of this. And I'll say two last quick things. Another is that companies care a great deal about their employees. We've seen this with Google and Amazon and Facebook all in the last several months, that the companies cannot recruit and retain the best employees if they aren't acting in ways that are consistent with their preferences. And we know that over 50% of the American population, including a disproportionately high percentage of people who are coming out of graduate schools, business schools, technical schools, care about climate a lot. So if you're running a major tech company or software company, you're not going to recruit and retain the best employees unless you have a good climate reputation. And then you see firms starting to do a lot of things like make commitments to 100% renewable power. Last thing I'll say, it's very hard to define, but I believe that the norms of corporate managers matter quite a bit. Hard to study, hard to define, but in many cases, a corporate manager has some decisional space. They're not acting in a way that's outside of what is arguably in the best interest of shareholders, but within that decisional space, then their norms become very important. And I think if you see company after company after company, what you find is that very often there was someone in the C-suite, on the board of directors, high up in the company, who cared a great deal about these issues. And then again, within the ability to meet profitability and shareholder value concerns, was able to push the company in the direction of reducing carbon emissions. So that's a really long answer, but a sense of why I think government will do less than I wish it would, and why there is more opportunity than many of us think on the private sector side.
As we enter into the presidential campaign, progressives look skeptically at business, at banks and insurance companies. But your work sees corporations as a part of the solution. How do you respond to progressives who see corporations as the problem?
That's a great question. And I think we have to first step back and realize that liberals and conservatives, or progressives and conservatives, view the world very differently and use very different language to do so. And I think one of the problems is there is research that suggests that conservatives can tell you what a liberal is thinking. They may not agree with it, but they can tell you what they're thinking. But liberals have a really hard time telling you what a conservative is thinking. And I think at the root of much of the problems that we're seeing is the inability to understand the different worldviews and the tendency to demonize those worldviews. And again, I tend to come from a more liberal perspective myself, but I do research on trying to understand how people from across the political spectrum understand issues. And I think what we see is massive growth in polarization in the United States since 1990. We've gotten to the point where in Congress, essentially, you can predict the vote on almost any environmental legislation by whether someone is a Republican or a Democrat. And that just didn't exist in 1990-92. It was there somewhat, but it's gotten much, much worse. And now that has infiltrated the entire population, where you can even predict which kind of home pesticides people use based on their political position. And so my view on that is that that is a fundamental threat to progress, because again, given the constitutional design, you don't get from here to a Green New Deal or from here to a carbon tax unless you find a way to expand the size of the population that is interested in doing something about this. And I think the way to get to that is to understand, it's something that Dave Roberts first spoke to, it's called tribal epistemology, that we are not using an information deficit model when we acquire new information. What we are doing, in other words, it's not that we lack information and then we move forward, and once we gain information, we just accept the new idea. What we do is we tend to look, we have a worldview or an ideology, and we look for cues from our tribal leaders, and we get those cues through channelized information. I have a paper called Social Checks and Balances, where I'm trying to tackle the channelized flows of information. But if I'm liberal, I can watch MSNBC, I can get a Twitter feed and Facebook and so forth. All of it just reaffirming the facts and opinions that I want to hear. If I'm conservative, I can do Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and Twitter and Facebook and blah, blah, blah. And so what happens is tribal leaders signal what I can believe in terms of facts and how I should view them in terms of opinions. Then the information feeds work to make it clear what those signals are. And then I simply adopt those. And I think that's the place that we're in right now. And that's why I think we have to both do the best we can to break down those channels and to think about what it is we share in common. Where are the crossover points? What is it that if I'm a progressive and I want to see a particular outcome, how can I find a way to agree on the outcome, even if some of the ways along the pathway from here to there aren't ones that I would adopt? Because simply being right but not achieving change is a disaster for future generations. We cannot afford not to massively reduce our carbon emissions in the future. And this, the hubris of thinking that everyone else believes what I believe and that I have the power to overcome everyone else is frankly not a democratic idea. And it is destructive, I believe, to our ability to achieve a future that doesn't include a catastrophic climate.
You suggest some government action will be required. Does your work on private governance point towards or favor one particular approach to the government intervening, or one regulatory instrument over another, one policy program over another?
I would say that there are a couple of features. That's another great question. I would say there are a couple of features that are essential that can facilitate both a public and a private action. I don't think the work that we do signals that one particular approach should be dominant over the other. I do think that government disclosure of enormous amounts of data and creating transparency allows procurement requirements and customer changes and reputation and others to drive corporate and government behavior. So I think that's a feature of this that's very important. I think government procurement requirements are very important on top of everything else that we do. I think strong government enforcement of public laws is really important, because otherwise companies that comply feel like dupes and you undercut the likelihood that you'll get action. So I think all of those matter a great deal in this space. So I think that what you might try to do, what we try to do as we think through these issues, is say, you know, which of these private sector actions are likely to build a constituency for government action? And so, for example, what I think you're seeing in many cases is, you know, things such as the Renewable Energy Buyers Alliance making a transition from being a 501c3 to being a trade association. You're seeing organizations start off trying to support pure corporate action in effect and trying to lower some barriers to uptake of renewables, and you're seeing some of those organizations transition into a place where they're trying to create better government regulatory frameworks for that to happen. Similarly, when companies commit to make major carbon emissions reductions, they are now in a position where two things happen. One, it's in their interest to force other companies to do the same thing, so they're not competitively disadvantaged. But also, they now are in a position where people can say that they're acting hypocritically if they don't also support government policies that do that. So I think what happens, and you see this in several different sectors going on right now, is a company or a sector gets out there and making climate commitments, and then everyone starts pointing out, sure, you're doing that as a company, but you're also funding all these trade associations that are trying to undermine exactly the goals that you've committed to. And then a company feels called out on that, and to keep their reputation, they then have to agree to pull back funding from those lobbying organizations, or they have to agree to try to change the lobbying positions of those organizations. So I think there is what we think of as positive spillover here. There are ways in which the private sector action then can drive more public sector action.